Hello, this short podcast is discussing the questions in Seminar 2. Taking questions 1 and 2 together at one level, because they're starred, that indicates they're the sorts of questions which could come up as exam questions. And what's really being asked of you is that you consider your own views, actually, in relation to these topics, and you consider them probably across the entirety of the course. So what we're really getting at this stage with Seminar 2 is to think about financial regulation in response to these questions, particularly how does it relate to substantive law, and also how does it respond to ideas like the usefulness of having high-level principles, the usefulness of having so-called light-touch regulation. So beginning with question 1, what is the difference between regulation and substantive law? I'm doing another podcast on this, which you can find online, about the difference between substantive law and regulation. I discuss this in Chapter 3 in the textbook at some length. You see, we might expect at first blush that regulation is going to be something similar to the criminal law, as though we're going to be creating some kind of policeman who is going to oversee markets and make sure no one behaves in a bad way and so on and so forth. The problem with regulation in that sense is that it's actually far more nuanced in its practice. And while there is a supervision manual in the FSA handbook, while there are lots of powers, as we're going to see in later topics in relation to market abuse and so on and so forth, nevertheless, the Financial Services Authority has obligations in the statute, Financial Services and Markets Act 2000, which have absolutely nothing to do with a kind of coercive regulatory response. Because the FSA has an economic role to ensure competition within markets. And importantly, and controversially amongst some people, to ensure the competitive position of the UK economy as against other economies, and therefore other economies' financial markets. So immediately, just at that level, we have a tension between someone who is supposed to control financial behaviour on the one hand, and that same person, the FSA, also needing to ensure that the economy remains competitive, which in public debate has related to London as a financial centre, the need to keep business coming to London. And so we might think, well, how can this person, the FSA, on the one hand, be policing people's activity, on the other hand, be encouraging it? And of course, you might say there's a middle line between those two, quite sensibly, that you can be encouraging useful, sensible, productive economic activity in financial markets. You can encourage profit without encouraging stupidity. And so one of the great criticisms you might make in the wake of the global financial crisis is that the FSA simply failed to regulate appropriately. It allowed things to spin out of control when in fact it should have stopped them happening. It should have realised that these things created too much risk. And so that really is the heart of why regulation is different from substantive law. Substantive law is not ordinarily concerned as an actor in promoting economic activity. Now you may find judgments like Lord Wolff in Westdeutsche Landesbank in Islington in 1996, talking about the need to ensure that the substantive law doesn't do anything which discourages people from coming to England and Wales and using English law. But that, I would suggest, happens occasionally, whereas it's written into the statute that the FSA has to behave in this fashion. The FSA also has an obligation to educate, to promote, in quotes, public awareness of financial markets and so on and so forth. So that clearly goes far beyond simply controlling how markets would behave. We don't expect that lawyers have to go out and educate the public in the way the FSA is required to by statute. So we have an educative role for the FSA, we have an economic role to do with competition, to do with the place of London within the UK economy. We also have an obligation to maintain the integrity of the financial system. I think we might think justice is blind at this level in relation to substantive law. We might hope that judges have the nous not to create judgments which are going to harm the financial system. But again, the FSA has this as a role and as an actor. And one of the most important things, I think, is the way in which the FSA consults on its regulations. Very, very different from the way in which substantive law works. No point do judges go out and consult on what the law on murder should be amongst murderers, whereas the FSA does go out and consult with bankers about how bankers should be regulated, with financial institutions about how financial institutions should be regulated. So there's a great difference there about the nature of financial regulation and the way in which financial regulation comes into being. That said, you may on the other hand say, well, a lot of people get to lobby Parliament about the contents of statutes. Okay, we might not be able to lobby judges in the same way, although some people do try, but maybe we get to lobby Parliament about statute. So I think for every time you can point to an obvious distinction between regulations of substantive law and the abstract, if you think about it a bit more deeply and think about some of the law you've studied actually, those two things possibly come together a little bit more closely than one might expect. I think therefore it becomes a question of degree. You know, the degree to which the Financial Services Authority consults is very different from the way in which judges ever behave, if they do listen to people outside the courtroom and so on and so forth. The second question, what's the purpose behind high-level regulatory principles? What are the advantages and disadvantages of using high-level principles and light-touch regulation? Well, let's take the second one first. What is light-touch regulation? Light-touch regulation is concerned with not interfering too much. It's regulating, but not getting so close to financial institutions that you stop their innovation, that you stop them doing exactly whatever it is they feel they need to do to live, thrive and survive. Light-touch regulation has therefore been blamed in part for the global financial crisis, in that it's said by some that the regulators simply didn't get close enough to financial institutions to find out what they were doing and to stop them doing things that were inappropriate. In defence of the FSA, in defence of Alistair Darling too, if back in the late 1990s and thereafter anyone had said we are going to regulate these people more closely, they would have been howled down. It would have been thought ludicrous, particularly for a Labour administration. It would have been impossible coming into power for the first time in a generation, then to start fighting the city. That would have been the end of Labour in power, I think, forever. You know, we would have seen the pound plummet and all those kind of things. Labour had to come in showing it was in support of what appeared to be an economic miracle. A kind of Clinton economic miracle in the US seemed to be washing over to the UK as well. And everyone got very blind to the fact we were involved in a big boom that was utterly unsustainable. And sustainability is a useful metaphor, I think. Anyone studying environmental law, you might ask whether or not this is sustainable development at all. So that's light-touch regulation. That is to do with regulatory practice, I would suggest. As compared with high-level principles, which is a question of how the regulations are created and the style of the regulations, rather than the way in which they're implemented. So high-level principles revolve around the principles for businesses, which is the first rule book in the FSA handbook. And I think the useful place to start, as per the lecture handout, is with those central principles, particularly the first one, integrity. Now, going back to the first question, the relationship between regulation and substantive law, we might say that building our regulatory system on a central principle of integrity, you know, little like thou shalt act with integrity, sounds rather like equity's notion of acting in good conscience, the centrality of an idea of the duty of care, and the neighbour principle from Donoghue and Stevenson in tort law, for example. So high-level principles, in that sense, mimic things that are done in the common law and in equity. On the other hand, people often say, well, they're far too vague. Who's the they? I think in the abstract you ask people, well, bankers are required to act with integrity. At first blush, that sounds vague, particularly as the Principles for Businesses rulebook doesn't give us much of an explanation as to what that word means. I have a bash at it in the textbook. The other people who say that these high-level principles are too vague are the bankers themselves. There certainly was a sense amongst a number of bankers, certainly before the MiFID directive, the Markets in Financial Instruments Directive, that we discussed in detail in Conduct of Business Regulation, before MiFID was introduced, the regulation that really introduced high-level principles par excellence, that firms must act in the best interests of their clients, the best execution principle, that they must seek the best price available for their client. The firm said, we don't know what we're supposed to do to comply with these regulations. The firms, in many senses, would have preferred to have more rigorous regulation, because then they would know when they were complying and when they were not complying. So there's a disadvantage in high-level principles in a compliance sense, because banks don't know what it is they're required to do. But one of the mooted advantages of that vagueness is that it requires banks, at a very ethical level, to sit down and think, well, what is it we must do to ensure that we are dealing with our customers appropriately? What is it that we are doing in our business practices that makes them integrous in some ways and not integrous in others? So, swings and roundabouts, as with all these things. A lot of that will swim into focus more when we come to conduct of business regulation next, when we look in detail at how is it that financial institutions are supposed to deal with their clients. But those are some of the key grounds and areas of debate there, just at that level. Three, how is regulatory policy developed in the EU? Well, the handout flows through from the Treaty of Rome, through the various reports, the Segrè report, the Financial Services Action Plan. We've had the development of decisions like Cassis de Dijon, the principle of direct effect generally in European law. What hasn't happened is that no spontaneous securities market across Europe sprang into being. No single financial services market across Europe sprang into being. And so instead, the Lamfalussy methodology was introduced to make the European legislative process more nimble, more reactive to market change. And I think the Investment Services Directive of 1993 is a good illustration of this. The financial derivatives markets, options, forwards, swaps, and all those lovely things discussed in Chapter 43 really came into their own in the early 1990s. I mean, they've been in existence from earlier than that in the 80s, but it's really in the 90s that those markets exploded, I would suggest. And the Investment Services Directive simply hadn't anticipated that kind of change. And so a long time had been spent on that regulatory structure under the Investment Services Directive of 93, and it was pretty much out of date as soon as it was implemented. So, hence, Lamfalussy provides a way of producing legislation that's more reactive, that's much quicker, gives the Commission power to create technical regulations, and creates that CESA group among the Committee of European Securities Regulators who can meet, who can share their experiences across Europe and coordinate regulation. Always we've got this double-sided coin. On the one hand, what do the regulations say? On the other side of that coin, how are those regulations actually being implemented? So it's a question of what's in the rule book and how is that being put to work that's important. Four, in what ways might we say that EU financial services policy moved towards an Anglo-Saxon regulatory model? The fact that, for example, FSMA encourages the, or requires the FSA to encourage innovation in financial markets, to encourage competition, and so on and so forth. The fact that regulatory practice seems to have been very light touch, if you look at any of the reports by the FSA on the global financial crisis, you'll see a lot of self-reflection on how light touch were they. Did they get close enough to the firms during that crisis? So the very fact that we were allowing innovation, there was some laissez-faire there, quite important. The speech by Sarkozy, I think it was during 2009, which I'll show a clip of during lectures, where he said, le laissez-faire, c'est fini. End of laissez-faire, as far as the French are concerned. There's been a huge reaction amongst particularly the French and the Germans against what they see as an Anglo-Saxon regulatory model. The other thing that's considered to be Anglo-Saxon, i.e. coming from the US and from the UK, it's an odd usage, but there we are, is the very idea that we're going to use securities markets. We're going to use all these clever financial products like derivatives, like securitization, which have caused, of course, so much of the problems in the last couple of years. That we're going to use those kind of clever financial techniques to provide funding as opposed to the much more cautious models in continental Europe of ordinary bank borrowing. In Germany, for example, the local lenders bank, like Westdeutsche Lenders Bank, would tend to work far more closely with manufacturers and their borrowers on their business plans, would tend to have a long-term relationship with them. Slightly more distant, slightly more impersonal securities market, where you're simply issuing shares or bonds into a general market, is far more a UK and a US model. You're looking for a large number of investors to buy small numbers of your shares or bonds or whatever it may be, each. And so you're not trying to forge a relationship with those investors in the same way that a large bank coming to know one of its borrowers really well would be. And so there's a thought there as well that this whole drift, Lamfalussy and afterwards, all the securities regulation we'll talk about later in the course, is to do very much with something that comes from the US and the UK and isn't the way in which continental Europe has always done business. That's not to say they didn't have securities markets. That's not to say that in the UK and the US there isn't a lot of lending in an ordinary, traditional way and bankers coming to know their clients, but certainly not in the same way, not with quite the same culture, and certainly not the same long-term culture where you expect your profits to come to you slowly over time. So that's really what Four was getting at. The financial services policy seems to have moved towards the Anglo-Saxon model, and Angela Merkel, Nicolas Sarkozy, seem to be indicating that they want Europe to move away from that now. So that's the debate that's raging at the minute. What are the FSA's regulatory objectives? Well, they're identified in Chapter 8 in the textbook in detail. I'm doing a separate podcast on the FSA, so you can look those up, because I'm aware this one's getting quite long. Discuss them under question one, really, some of the key ones. There's a coercive regulatory role, there's an economic role, there's also an educative role, there's a role about maintaining market integrity. So there are a number of objectives there. Six, what types of regulatory goals is the FSA required to pursue by statute? And are there the sorts of regulatory goals it might expect from a financial regulator? That goes back to a lot of what I've said under questions one and two already. So I think you can see that there's an essay title there somewhere. Yeah, who knows how it'll come up. Have a look at the specimen exam paper about thinking about what's regulation for and how does it actually work, and what we might think regulation is in the abstract. Is that how it really seems to work in practice on the current financial regulatory model? So that's what you're just starting to think about in this first podcast. What would we expect a regulator to be doing? And actually, when we look at the statute and think, well, what are those obligations on the FSA, is that what we would expect at all?